to Desert Island Strips. I'm your host, Nasty Canasta, and my castaway on the island today is a burlesque performer, producer, and teacher based here in Brooklyn, New York. She got her start performing through London's Whoopee Club in 2006 and has since performed across the USA and throughout the world. She's currently the producer of Wolfshine Burlesque in Brooklyn and host of the Lunch with Legs podcast. That's a little bit of a hint. Offstage, she's a rebirthing breathworker, Wu Tao dance teacher, body worker, and Reiki practitioner. She teaches self-transformation classes for both burlesque dancers and non-dancers alike. She studied shamanism, astrology, tarot, feng shui, and continues to learn and study extensively and has a formal academic training in art history and contemporary art as well. So it is my pleasure to welcome to the island the girl with the 34.5-inch inseam, Legs Malone.
Hey, Nasty Canasta.
Hi, Legs Malone. Welcome. I love asking people what their description of what they do is, and I love what you said. You're a self-described healing arts hustler.
Yeah.
How do your studies in the healing arts, how does that ever, or does it inform your burlesque performance, do you think?
Well, I would have to say that the word that's coming to mind is predilection, for sort of all things healing arts-based and well-being promotion. It was within that quest for my own balance and trying to come to a deeper place of peace with myself and my body and my, you know, what the hell I was doing with my life, that I received literally the message that I would find my greatest joy in becoming a burlesque performer. And at that time, I did not know what a burlesque was. And I have been a lifelong dancer. I mean, apparently my father asked me when I was like 8 years old what I wanted to be when I grew up. And my response was a soloist. And he said, in what? And I said, a soloist.
Oh, that's delightful.
So I have always loved being on stage. It's for me, it's a real, there's a part of me that lights up on stage. Yeah, I'd have to say burlesque has very much been a part of my own healing path. And as a result, I tend to look at it very spiritually. And so for me, my favorite acts, the ones that really light me up, are the ones that are conceptually really intelligent, well thought through, really clean delivery, clean, direct, just like, you know, arrow into a target thunk. It's just like, oh, yes. And also ones that where the performer, you know, the performer is very present in spirit and clearly presence as well, physically speaking. But when my perception of their body falls away and I am seeing the essence of them in that moment, that for me is transcendent and speaks to something far deeper than, you know, anything else happening in a dingy back room of some bar could ever, you know, otherwise speak to. So
given that, and this all makes great good sense to me, but do you find that there are moments when that's just completely at odds with the reality of, say, that dingy back room or even that very fancy front room or whatever? Is it hard to maintain that perspective or that purpose?
Absolutely. I think there are times where, and it tends to be when I am tired or stressed out or am preoccupied, where I'm not present in the moment. If I've just come, you know, gotten off of work, or I suddenly realize that I'm late on a deadline for some work, or I haven't promoted this, that, the other thing, and I show up to a show, and it's when my energy is low, which thankfully doesn't happen often, but it's when it's low and it's just when like attracts like, and I am bringing a sort of low energy on stage and it just attracts similar low energies. And I would have to say conversely, well, before I get to that, there are also times when I find certain performers who I know and love are really down in the moment or just generally down on themselves. When that energy gets sort of put into, I mean, for lack of a better term, the vortex of that show experience. And even, you know, especially if the host is having a bad day and, you know, they end up taking the bait from, you know, a negative audience member. And it's just like, that bums me out.
Yeah.
Again, we're human, so it's going to happen. But conversely, I mean, on the flip side of that, when I can be centered in myself and just be really conscious of why I'm there, what I'm doing, and not thinking past that. Just mm-hmm. like, I'm here to perform this act for this amount of money, and I'm going to share this moment with the audience, and then I'll be complete. You know, and just really being able to boil it down to that exact moment, then like any extraneous stress or passing judgments or feelings I may have just sort of get put to the sidelines mm-hmm. and I can do my thing and then be done with it. And I have to say, when I first started performing, I mean, I was so lit up and I was like, yes, like this is what I'm doing. This, I love this. I want to do this for the rest of my life. And I would be so excited to, you know, go out to the bar afterwards and talk to audience members and take pictures. And it was wonderful. And something switched probably about, I mean, it could have been as long as 5 years ago, as more recently as like 2 or 3 years ago. But I was just suddenly like, whatever excess energy I had that was like just faucet had gotten turned on by doing burlesque, it, whatever the overflow was, just petered out. And yeah. I could turn off the faucet and be like, you know what? I'm showing up and doing my work. Mm-hmm. I'm probably not going to leave the dressing room, especially after the show. And I get it. It's, I mean, for the most part, audience members, you know, who come up to me, or most people I know, performers, most of them are just super fucking excited. Exactly. And they want to, like, share some stuff. But then sometimes the energy can shift a yes. bit. And it happens with both men and women mm-hmm. of all cultures and backgrounds, where it's, they want more than just to express mm-hmm. how much they enjoyed or, you know, were moved by whatever piece I was doing. And I can sense like, this is someone who either hasn't been listened to for most of their life. And so has developed a thought like, I got to get this point across and like hammer it in. Because otherwise I'm not going to be heard or I'm not going to be acknowledged. Or like, I you know, would love to, you know, compliment this person. So they, you know, want to, you know, hook up with me or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, oh no. Okay. Like I'm a firm believer in giving a gift with no expectation of anything in return. Mm-hmm. So like when I go up, I'll never forget the first time I met Julie Atlas Muse, who's one of my heroes. It was years ago. I think it was like New Year's 2000, going into 2007. And she and Dirty and Bob and Murray were doing a show at Mo Pitkins. Mm-hmm. And I went up to her afterwards and was just like shaking. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought you were really amazing. And she was super gracious. And then there's a point where I would sense like she'd totally done talking to me. And I was yeah. like, cool. Thank you so much. Yep. Like, Happy New Year. And that was that. And I feel like when audience members can, you know, have the grace mm-hmm. to do that, it makes me more willing to spend time with them.
Yes.
And it's not, I'm not averse to spending time with the audience. And it's always really affirming when people are like, hey, great job. And hey, thanks. Can I get a picture? Yeah, sure. Have a great night. Thanks.
Yep.
Like that to me is bliss. I love that.
So that was a great segue, by the way.
Okay,
so you mentioned Julie Atlas Muse. So the first act you'd throw onto the boat and take to the island with you. Tell me about that one.
So it is Julie Atlas Muse's act to I Put a Spell on You. And in it, begins sort of scantily clad in a sort of all black. And anyway, she slowly turns around and she's wearing this. It looks like she's holding a wriggling hand. And like a hand that has just been lopped off from a body. And she's holding it and the hand is moving. And she's just sort of gaily smiling, turning around. And then the hand, she's dancing with it, and she looks at it and realizes the hand is moving. And she freaks out, and the hand sort of grabs her and anyway hypnotizes her. And the hand basically has its way with Julie. I know, put me down. And it is the most brilliantly... That act, I mean, Julie in particular, there are very few performers I know across many styles, media, who so fully inhabit the moment and so completely get yeah. out of their own way
yep.
for the art to come through them. she is such a joy to watch. And even though I've seen that act 25 times, mm-hmm. maybe more, I can't take my eyes off her when she's doing it.
It's deceptively simple.
I mean, I studied... I've been an art historian, academically speaking, for undergrad and graduate school. And in graduate school, I studied contemporary art. And within that, we studied video artists and, you know, the different, you know, mm-hmm. when the artist became part of their own art, as opposed mm-hmm. to like a painting or a sculpture. And there is such simplicity and thus such richness in Julie's performances. It's really like, you know, the shortest distance between A and B is a straight line. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, Julie just beams that. I mean, that she is someone who was born to be on stage. And that act, like I said, I mean, she inhabits it so fully musically. She knows, I mean, she's been doing that act for a decade, mm-hmm. if not longer. And her body knows that act. And I think that's one of the ways and reasons why it's just such a huge gift to watch. Because she's extraordinary. And as an artist, I think she's probably one of the most brilliant and important artists of, you know, today, period, mm-hmm. both in New York City and internationally.
So as far as, because you have this background in art history and also mm-hmm. some academic background in contemporary art, and, I mean, we spend so much time doing, you know, a little show in the back room of a bar and whatever. And I don't think that a lot of people, a lot of burlesque performers kind of look beyond that just because this is what we do and this is what we're doing it. Do you think that there is a, where is this all situated within sort of capital C, capital A, contemporary arts and, or is there even a possibility for that? Or is it a folk art or is it a,
that is such a good question. I have to say it has been a dream of mine, although the dream has sort of faded a little bit just because life. I really wanted, my primary reason for going to contemporary art school was to become a curator. Mm-hmm. And I really would love for there to be a show called The Art of Burlesque, mm-hmm. somewhere like MoMA, somewhere like the New Museum, because I feel that burlesque historically has been a low art. Mm-hmm. It has been an art for the people. It started off, you know, as extremely risque. I mean, it still is very much so, but back then, you know, you show an ankle and people yep. freak the fuck out. That to me is just, I mean, it's hilarious in so many ways. I mean, it also speaks to like when I'm like, oh my God, I totally can't imagine. Like, oh wait, hold on. Look at Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Look at the Middle East where if a woman shows an ankle, she could be killed, mm-hmm. depending on how, you know, like severe the, you know, the government is wherever mm-hmm. they live. So that sort of gives me space within that. But going back to your question, I feel there are burlesque artists working now who absolutely cross so many barriers. Mm-hmm. Between art forms, between appreciation. And whereas, I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of burlesque performers, you know, back in the 50s, you know, even earlier, who I feel should absolutely be included in a museum, but because they were solely showcasing their bodies and, you know, right. the sensuality of that, it's such a straightforward performance or exchange, mm-hmm. whereas people go there to see it done. That is still payment for art, but the reason behind it, the dynamic or the intent behind it is a very sexual one mm-hmm. and thus a very charged one. Mm-hmm. So I think modern Moors cannot look at that because right. of our hair, especially in America with our puritanical inheritance. Mm-hmm. And especially now with like the Christian right and people who call themselves Christians who clearly don't know the first thing about Christianity, but that is another discussion for another day.
Yes.
So I do feel there are a lot of performers performing now who should absolutely be institutionally recognized, mm-hmm. who are doing things that are performance art done within the context of burlesque. Mm-hmm. But also that burlesque is like painting. It is a genre. When people say, you know, I'm a burlesque performer, people go, oh. But then if somebody were to say, like, oh, I'm a painter, Oh, I'm a musician.
What kind of music do you play?
What kind of music? What kind of
your
art?
Medium
is it like Picasso? Is it like Chagall? What's going on? I'm like, nah, I'm more like Giotto with a touch of Michelangelo. Whatever it is. It's time for us to start, as a the burlesque community, I mean, people working within the scene, to start giving ourselves more credit and start recognizing the interdisciplinary, I was trying to make that a noun, interdisciplinality of the work and its application through many contexts, and in a lot of ways could easily fit into a discussion or an exhibition around art. Absolutely. I mean, I pitched something to the Brooklyn Museum when they were doing, I think they're still doing it, the Thursday nights in the summertime.
Yeah.
And I proposed very tightly curated exhibition of performative art that is primarily burlesque, but people bring their own stuff in, and I wanted to book people who really do step outside of that mold, many of whom I think I've cited as my desired desert island strips. So I think that it is absolutely applicable. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of opening people to open up their eyes to the myriad of possibilities of burlesque being considered more than just burlesque, being seen for the art, putting the art in art form, you know, and also for people to loosen up about sexuality in the naked female form, because that definitely throws a wrench into a lot of people's inner workings.
Most definitely.
And the last thing I'll say about this question is I really wish that the arts were better funded in America. I started doing burlesque in London, where the Arts Council, which is the national arts organization funding, will regularly give money to performers, producers who are wanting to mount either a singular act, an entire show, a touring show, whatever it is. The arts are supported there, and it is a cultural reflex to go see shows, no matter what they are. Are they plays? Are they art shows? I mean, like, so many of the national museums are free there.
Yeah.
Whereas here, MoMA costs $20. America, the American society has made it very challenging to regularly consume and expose yourself to art without missing rent.
Tell me about your second desert island strip.
So the second desert island strip is Little Brooklyn's King Kong act. I saw this act for the first time at Starshine Burlesque, RIP, and it was right before Brooklyn was going to the Miss Exotic World competition in Vegas, where she had been selected to compete for what is now known as the Reigning Queen of Burlesque, back then was known as Miss Exotic World. I love Little Brooklyn so fucking much. Again, this was another performer where I was like, Jesus Christmas, what act am I going to pick? And I was like, okay, that one conceptually blows everything I've ever seen out of the water. It is head-shakingly stunning. I mean, I've seen the act so often that I've been able to, while engrossed in it, just even listen to the music and consider the musicality and the movements she's chosen. For those who have never seen it, she is both Fay Wray and the gorilla. Love is a Many Splendid Thing. It is amazing. It starts off, you know, with her as the screaming woman being terrified, and then Kong falls in love with her and sort of seduces her, but with Little Brooklyn's trademark just gut-busting humor and the intelligence. Again, that is a performer who expresses everything with such clarity that, A, she so fully inhabits the moment that you cannot take your eyes off of her, even if you tried. That act, I mean, it is so concise and tight and smart. I mean, so fucking smart and tight. And it's just, oh.
Yeah, no,
she's a genius. Absolutely.
So you talked a little bit about that you got your start in London in burlesque, and that was in 2006. So it was a while ago.
Back in the day.
How long before you came back to New York, where you're originally from? And how long were you performing out there?
I had been living in London for 2.5 years, but it was towards the end of my stay there that I was introduced to burlesque. Mm-hmm. Burlesque was brought to my attention in April of 2006. Legs Malone was born on September 6th, 2006. And at the time, I was applying for a work visa to stay in London. It was my dream to live there. I had gone to graduate school there. I had gotten a job. And we were applying for a work visa so that I could stay. And I think that visa process had started in, like, January of 2006.
Right.
And it was one of the most grueling, soul-sucking endeavors I have ever embarked upon. Mm. And burlesque, for me, came along at the perfect time. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I was desperate. And it was so tragic. It was beyond tragic for me. It was like a death mm-hmm. when I suddenly started to realize I can't stay here. Mm-hmm. So burlesque was very much my saving grace. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I moved back here. I came back in December. I went back to London and packed all my stuff up mm-hmm. and left in February. So my first New York performance was in January of 2007. So I was really performing in London for less than a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, not even 6 months. But I went deep, mm-hmm. so as to say, like, I just started going to all the shows that I could, met lots of producers, just, like, soaked it in. And when I came home, I was so sad and so depressed that I hadn't made it, quote-unquote, that I didn't want to see any friends. I didn't want to leave the house. I was living at my dad's. In a little spare bedroom. I mean, it was serious, like, pity party time. but the only thing that got me out of the house was going to burlesque shows, mm-hmm. including yours, Sweet and Nasty.
No, I remember seeing meeting you after week. A lot of shows before I saw you perform, which I always...
Because that was my refuge. Mm-hmm. I wanted to focus on what brought me joy, which was burlesque, and not the fact that, like, all of my dreams had just been dashed. Mm-hmm. When in reality, like, a whole new and a much better situation was on the rise.
Was there any sort of artistic cultural shock between the London scene and the New York scene?
Absolutely. Yeah. London, when I got started, was being overrun by what some of the old guard called the Frilly Knickers Brigade.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Where the old school performers who really brought it mm-hmm. were like, who the fuck are these newbies who are thinking if they bedeck themselves in agent provocateur or, you know, mind you, unrhinestoned or extremely fancy whatever with beautiful silk this, beautiful silk that, little ruffly panties, you know, perfect silk stockings, whatever, to just get up on stage and take it off and leave with no sense of musicality, of teasing, of involving the audience in your performance. I mean, I remember watching it being like, are you fucking kidding me? That person just got paid to do that act? Like, I, to quote the 80s, I could have had a V8. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it was so upsetting to me in so many ways. But at the same time, I was still seeing being like, I can do this. I know I can do this. Mm-hmm. And then coming back to New York City, I was knocked on my ass when I saw my first New York City show. When I saw, again, this was the New Year's at Mo Pitkins, because it was official, like, I was ringing in 2007. I knew that I couldn't live in London. I had to make peace with being in New York. And watching Julie do her Snow Queen act, in which she pulls a bag of cocaine out of her pussy.
Wow, I have not seen that act in ages.
I don't think she's done it in a really long time. And she did it on stage. And I, while prancing about, like, grinding her teeth.
Yeah.
That changed me on a cellular level. And I just suddenly realized, and then every time I've gone back to Europe, with plenty of wonderful exceptions, mm-hmm. for the most part, especially in England, the acts are a lot more staid and a lot more safe and lovely to watch. Mm-hmm. But it's like, and then what? Whereas in New York, I think it's a combination of having, you know, the huge convergence of so many people who are artistically minded coming here, moving here, mm-hmm. with their own backgrounds and forming their art in really unique and authentic ways. Mm-hmm. But also, we are so lucky to have so many shows all the time mm-hmm. that we can get on stage, week after week after week, sometimes night after night after night, and work our shit out and find out what works. And remember, it was Bob who said, like, you have to do an act for a year until your body knows it, and then you can start doing something with it. Yeah. And I remember hearing that being like, are you fucking kidding me? But I totally get it now.
Yeah.
Anyway, so all of that's to say, I love the rawness of the scene in New York City.
Well, speaking of representing the Frilly Knickers Brigade, then tell me about your third Desert Island Strip.
Oh, hey, it's you!
I usually don't allow that.
Because you, again, you are an extraordinary performer. It makes me so happy to see someone who is talented, intelligent, and loves being naked.
That's the key.
It absolutely is. No, it really that is the holy trifecta of a good burlesque act, in my humble opinion. The first time I ever saw it was from my show, the Legs Malone show, at the former Public Assembly. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen the act before. That show, the Legs Malone show, was, I called it a curated exhibition of performative art. Mm-hmm. I know I've already said that. But that was the show that I created that statement for. And I very consciously chose people who I both respected and admired as artists, but who I also knew could bring it for whatever theme I had chosen. And I don't remember the theme of that show
in particular. I don't either, but I remember the show. Yeah.
But, and I remember talking to you backstage, and you were like, I really don't want to put this mask on. It's going to make me claustrophobic, but I just have to do it. I was like, it's all good, you know. Anyway, and I remember watching in the audience, and it is to In the Mood by Glenn Miller. That song conjures so much for so many people, especially if they were alive during the war, World War II in specific. And you overlay the track with the sounds of bombs dropping. And especially coming from London, and where I was living in London, I once had, I took a cab ride home and I ended up talking to the cabbie who had grown up, I lived in East London.
Yeah.
And he had grown up in the neighborhood where I was living.
Oh, wow.
And he was like 5 or 6 after the bombing. And he described to me what it was like to all of that. I'm having goosebumps up and down my body as I'm describing this, about how he and his friends would go out in the mornings after the bombings, because it happened night after night after night, and they would claim houses that had been completely bombed out, and they would play in these bombed out neighborhoods, but with that beautiful childlike innocence. Yeah. But I can only imagine in what looked like a war zone, because it was.
Because it was.
And seeing your act, there was such a sublime energy to that juxtaposition of the glamour and your beauty, your physical beauty in that dress, that stunning skirt, all like tulle, waltzing around to that song, which is such a beautiful song, and so evocative.
It's an eerie song, but beautifully so.
Absolutely. I mean, it is so evocative. I think there's so much psychic energy attached to that song that people hear it and they're like, huh? You know, even if they've never heard it before, even if they were born, like, you know, 5 years ago, it speaks to the heart in such a profound way. But then to hear the bombs dropping and to see you in the gas mask, it's profound. Profound. And it I've seen it several times. It's what do you call that act? Does it even
blitz.
Have a name?
The
blitz.
Yeah.
We can't see your face for the duration of the act at all. And there's such a beautiful anonymity in that, but punctuated with you that is not anonymous. And that's just such a stunning juxtaposition for me.
You know, the sounds from that are actually, there's a BBC archive of people who actually went outside with tape recorders during the bombing.
Jesus
so all
Christ.
Of the noises from that are actually recorded in London during various bombings during the Blitz.
I have to say, I mean, just one last thing about living in London, where I was living when I was talking to this cabbie. Everything where I lived, I lived in Bethnal Green on the edge of Mile End, right next to the canal. And the cabbie told me there was one building left standing.
Wow.
One. And it was actually across the canal from our house.
Oh, wow.
And it was this crazy pub, crazy fucking pub. It could be a portal into another dimension for all I know. But it was called the Palm Tree. I think it was called the Palm Tree. And it is by the canal. It is by itself.
Oh, wow.
It's just green parkland all around it.
It's so present.
It is so present, and it's so easy to forget about.
Yeah.
So I think that's another reason why that act was, it moved me so deeply.
So tell us, what is Wu Tao?
Ah, yes, changing gears entirely. Yes. Wu Tao is a dance and meditation modality. It's very similar to Tai Chi and Qigong, but it was only created about 13 years ago in Western Australia by a woman named Michelle Locke. And she was a professional ballet dancer. She got an injury. She turned to Chinese medicine to heal herself, specifically shiatsu, and loved it so much that she ended up going to get her shiatsu certification. She ended up opening up a shiatsu school in Perth, where she is from, and was happily, you know, going along her healing path. In 2001, which is the year that Wu Tao was created, she gave birth to a daughter who had a severe disability that was diagnosed very soon after her birth, called Rett syndrome, which is a devastating disability. It only affects little girls, and the mortality rate is 100%.
Oh, wow.
And the girls don't usually live past 10 years old. So Michelle naturally was completely blindsided by this, and her daughter required 24-hour care. And so she sold the shiatsu school and started taking care of her daughter full-time. Australia being Australia, there was some great social care that came in.
Oh, right, of course.
And so she, once they got into a rhythm with that, she had more time on her hands. And she was finding that she was really missing dancing. And so she started getting studio time with a friend saying, okay, here's what I know from shiatsu. Here's what I know about all of the meridians and what traditional Chinese medicine tells us. How can we move and stretch ourselves to benefit the optimal flow of qi or vital life force within the meridians, but through dance? And pretty much Wu Tao was born instantly. So the reason I give that introduction beforehand is to share with whoever I'm speaking with the seeds of it, because it's such an unusual modality that people don't know about. And I was actually the first person certified and licensed to teach it in America. And there is, just as of like a month and a half ago, another Wu Tao teacher who moved from Germany to Oregon. So we've got one on each coast, which is a good start. I just taught this morning and I had someone show up and we were talking afterwards, and she said, like, how would you describe this? And I would say it's basically like medicine. Whereas Tai Chi and Qigong are really moving the full body and you're, you know, flowing the qi throughout all of the channels in your body, Wu Tao specifically targets meridians that are associated with the five elements in traditional Chinese medicine. So as you are moving and dancing, within that element, the choreographed movements are designed to stretch and stimulate those specific meridians that are associated with the element. And so there are associated seasons, colors, emotions, along with the meridian pathways. But there's a lot of visualization. We use our imagination a lot in the dances because it engages the full brain. The result of it, may you, you know, be in any state of health and any age and any shape or health of body, it's deep peace is what comes through. And I have been a shit meditator for the majority of my life. I have do my best. And I actually have to say I've gotten better at it, in the sense that when I say better at it, I mean I can come into that meditative space and be present within it for more than 35 seconds. And even if it's just 35 seconds, that's better than nothing. But with Wu Tao, I have found I drop into such a deep and completely quiet space. It's unlike anything I've ever tried. So the dances are between 4 and 6 minutes in length. There is specifically composed music to accompany each of the dances. And ideally, someone would come in and take like a 6-week course just to learn all of the dances, because there's lots of associated meditations, mm-hmm. and we do lots of stretches and stuff just to open up the body.
Right.
And then once you are familiar with the dances and start to do all 5 of them in the flow, the whole flow takes about a half hour. Mm. Your mind can just step out.
Yeah.
And it's just your body literally going through the motions. And my job as a teacher is to call not only prompts of movement, but also call in the imagination. I mean, that to me, that as a dancer and as somebody who was diagnosed with ADD, even though I'm so against that whole ADD, ADHD
it's racket,
it's nonsense. I mean, it's not nonsense. It's real. But that clinical definition of it does nobody any favors.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, again, another story for another discussion. But it, the movement in order to get silent is amazing. So I hope that answers the question.
Absolutely. So tell me, who is going to join you in the very small lifeboat as your performer that you're going to drag along
God.
With you to this island?
Oh, my God.
This
was such a hard question. I want to link my dinghy up with many other dinghies.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many performers that I want to bring along with me.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I did have to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so I chose Peekaboo Point,
mm-hmm.
who is one of my sister witches.
Mm-hmm.
She's a dear, dear, dear friend of mine. And not only do I value her as a colleague, as a performer, who fucking brings it
every
single time. I mean, she's a Capricorn, surprise, surprise, because she is so disciplined, and she has studied modern dance her whole life. And you can see it in her movements and everything. Apart from that, she's one of my closest friends, and I can think of no better way to just sit on a desert island, just like howling at the moon with laughter, than with Peekaboo.
And finally, because it's a small little raft, and there's not a lot of room for costumes, so you can only pick one of your own. So what act of yours are you bringing along?
I would have to bring an act that I actually haven't done in several years.
Mm.
It doesn't really have a name, because the music that was given to me, many years ago during a retreat in Esalen, or at Esalen, rather, in Big Sur, California.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who gave it to me, she's a life coach named Athena.
Oh,
I wish I could remember her last name.
Delightful.
And we did a movement piece to this song, and I was so moved by it that I went up to her and I was like, oh my God, how can I get a copy of that? She burned me a CD and gave it to me, because it was a mix that somebody that she knew in California had made. A song by Alice Coltrane, and I didn't find this out till many years later when I was listening to the radio one night. It's like a jazz station, and the song came on, and I was like, holy shit, that's the music, because I didn't know what this music was.
Yeah.
And it's by Alice Coltrane, who was John Coltrane's wife, who got very into Eastern spirituality, and it is a song called Turiya and Ramakrishna.
A dear friend,
and
whoever you are.
Anyway, the artist who compiled this track looped this one part of it and overlaid it with a spoken word piece by William Burroughs.
The more we realize that our life here in this world is a very brief span. There comes at last an end to everything. Time keeps passing. So it's important for us to talk about some important things.
I guess I could call it Come Home to Love, because that's the call at the end of the song.
Yeah.
But I come out completely veiled, wearing a vintage duster that I got from Holiday O'Hara.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I bought it from Holiday at Exotic World back in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I got it was because she had brought it to sell.
Yeah.
And she saw me, and I'm 5'11", and Holiday, at her highest height, was 6 foot, I think. And she's like, oh my God, you're tall. I have something. She ran upstairs, got it, brought it back down. I was like, abso-fucking-lutely, yep. I want this duster. And it is a full circle duster.
It's stunning.
Stunning.
It's a beautiful piece. And I didn't know that was hers. That's
yeah.
So wonderful.
And all of the pieces that I wear in it actually are some of my favorite items of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the act is me coming out. I have a veil. I remove the veil and I take off the robe. I take off the belt. I take off the robe. And I'm wearing this little, like, lace teddy thing underneath it that, P.S., I got at Victoria's Secret,
nice.
Like, 15 years ago during their, like, big sale time, their semi-annual sale. I was like, I don't know what the fuck this thing is, but I want it. But before I take that off, I remove my wig.
Mm.
And I created this act for when I had shaved my head.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to India, undergone a huge change, had chosen a method of purification called Mundan, which is a Hindu tradition in which the head is shaved to release all past karma. Mm. And so I came home very raw, very open,
mm-hmm.
and realized I finally could do an act of the song. Mm. And so I remove the wig, and then I remove everything else.
I think of it in this as a series of images, as a series of not static images, but still images that kind of flow one into the other.
I do miss doing the act, and mm-hmm. I'm sure I will bring it back. I do feel I need to have a shaved head for mm-hmm. it, just for the original concept of the piece and for yep. the follow through. And and I'm sure I will shave my head again mm-hmm. at some point while I'm still performing. As I speak to you with the longest hair that I've had
right?
in...
It's almost hitting your chin.
It's past
it's
my
past
chin.
It's past your chin.
I haven't had hair this long since March of 2009.
All right.
So it's been a minute. That is the act.
Mm-hmm.
Because that act to me, more than anything else I do, feels like an act of prayer,
mm-hmm.
where I go on stage and it's me saying, "People, I want you to hear this. I really want to give this to you."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, it's not an act that's appropriate for every show by all means, but it is my offering. Mm-hmm. It is an offering of medicine, of peace, of love, of accepting yourself.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful thing to have on this island with you.
Thanks.
Well, I'm going to dream of sunny skies and warm islands as we hit our snowstorm
as
the next 24
hours. As we descend into the pre-Thanksgiving snowstorm mm-hmm. that is on the way.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you,
Legs
Nasty.
Alone.
This was fantastic. And I hope that once the archipelago is established mm-hmm. and we all have our adorable dinghies with appropriate rhinestones and tassels galore, because you got to measure the wind. I hope you'll come visit me on my island.
I will indeed. Thank you, Megs.
Thank you.